and memory.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls, and you're listening to Rainbow Country.
Today on Rainbow Country, pistol in my pocket. That and more next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hello, my name is Conchita.
And I'm Barbecue.
And my name is Hardcora. And we are the B-Girls.
You're listening to
Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. As always, I am your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. Well, thanks to you, tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately, listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into an award-winning, nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So today, a spotlight on 1980s queer British artist Alana Paley, who rose to prominence in the 1980s first by being on the British comedy TV show The Comic Strip Presents, and the 1987 dark comedy film Eat the Rich. In 1991, Alana Paley was featured in the top 10 UK singles hit Human Nature by Gary Clale. But what really put Alana Paley on the map was their 1986 hit single Pistol in My Pocket, produced by hitmakers Stock, Aitken, and Waterman. We'll talk music, including their 2025 single, Winter of Love, as well as being on the forefront of gender identity back in the 1980s, alongside people like Boy George, Marilyn, and Lee Bowery. Today, Alana Paley identifies as a hyper-effeminate natal male. Plus, in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All of that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning playwright and author Brad Fraser reads from his book, All the Rage, a partial memoir in two acts and a prologue.
That autumn, Kate left town to do a show, and Tad sublet his place and moved in with me. One autumn night after leaving the club with Richard, the three of us went for a bite at a nearby restaurant. Afterwards, we took a shortcut through the alley that ran next to the Odeon Theater. By the time we were partway up the alley, we realized we were being followed by four men about our age. We shared a quick look and quickened our step. Our pursuers did the same, saying they were going to take Tad's fleece-lined leather coat off him. Tad said to them, "Come on, guys, we don't need any trouble." They laughed. We could hear them whispering, Faggots, cocksuckers, why are you walking so fast? Scared? We were terrified. We were also three guys who worked out, and they didn't look all that big. Just as we emerged from the alley across the street from the Hudson's Bay store, they rushed us. I could feel adrenaline flushing through my system. My father didn't teach me much in my childhood, but he did teach me how to put up a guard and throw a punch, and I started roaring insults at them in my most demonic voice. I blocked a couple of punches and slapped my attacker away just as I heard Tad call my name. Two of them were moving in on him. Richard was holding his own with his attacker, landing a few decent blows, so I punched one of Tad's assailants in the side of the head. He made a pained noise, and amazingly, they all took off. As we walked up Jasper Avenue, we were sky high with our victory, giddy and shaky. We dropped Richard off at his place and continued on to mine. As we passed under the dark shadow of the old train overpass that used to cross Jasper Avenue just west of 109th Street, we became aware of footsteps behind us. Our hearts sank. The whispering started again. The quartet was back, and now we were just two. Eventually, I ended up at the gay bar. I checked my parka and sidled up to the bar. There were more staff than patrons, but I wasn't there for company. As I ordered my usual Labatt's Blue, I caught the eye of an emaciated older man in an expensive leather coat staring at me from the other side of the square bar. Something about him seemed familiar. He smiled. It was Benny. My old fuck bud, Benny, the beautiful muscle man with a fat uncut cock, melon-like ass cheeks, and girlishly smooth skin. It was obvious he was in the late stages of AIDS. As I moved around the bar to greet him, I tried to hide my shock behind a surprised smile, but he saw right through it. As we hugged, he said, "It's okay." And that was the extent of our conversation about his health. I took the stool next to his as he looked me over with a smile, saying, "You're all right?" I nodded. "Good," he said. "Some of the guys I fucked with, they're not all right." Having no idea how to respond, I said, "It's good to see you." "You too. When I first got sick, I was laid up for a while, but I read about you when I started traveling again." Something hit me. "What happened to your accent?" Benny always had that sexy Texan twang. I remembered what he'd told me about himself in our first few meetings, born in Texas, a couple of brothers, worked at something to do with the steel industry, sales maybe, had a life partner who was much younger, and a brother who'd gotten into drug trouble in South America. Benny said, "Everything I told you about myself is a lie." He went on to explain to me he wasn't from Texas. He was from someplace in the Maritimes, and he didn't work in the steel industry. He worked for a major coke cartel that was smuggling blow into the country. I was so gobsmacked. Most people have an alter ego, but queer people in those days often had many identities, mostly forged out of necessity. We did what we had to do in order to survive. Nonetheless, when he was done, all I could do was gape at him. I said, "Everything?" He said, "Except the stuff about my partner. That was real." I had no idea what to say. Benny said, "All those condos and apartments we fucked in were safe houses. You have no idea the danger I put you and other people in. I had some pretty nasty people after my ass." I shook my head in shock. He put his hand over mine. It was cool, already slightly dead. "So what's happening with you?" Then he ordered us two more beers, and I brought him up to date with my life, Pete, and the play. When I was done, I could tell he was tired, so I offered to see him back to his hotel, but he said he was fine. He got off the stool to hug me, and I could feel the bones move loosely beneath his skin like the last few pretzel sticks in a nearly empty bag. Benny said, "Don't waste a minute." I kissed him quickly.
Up next, Pistol in My Pocket.
Hi, I'm Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, a memoir. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Rainbow Country,
Alana, hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm very well, thank you, Mark. How are you?
I am well, Alana. Thank you for being here to have your voice, your story be heard by the LGBT community and beyond. So thank you for this. Okay, let's just jump
well,
right in.
Well, it's nice to be interviewed for a change by somebody who's well.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay. I never thought the day would come.
You are a recording artist. You are a theater and cabaret performer, an actor, an entertainer. Your first single, your very first single, Pistol in My Pocket, released in 1986. Yeah. Your most recent single, 2025's Winter of Love. Your first single, Pistol in My Pocket, was produced by the production team of Stock, Aitken and Waterman, charted internationally, including in the UK, Australia, New Zealand, was a number one dance floor hit. My understanding, Alana, my understanding is that Pistol in My Pocket essentially came about because of a meeting that you had with Pete Waterman in his office. Talk to me about this meeting, how it came about, and how this fantastic song, Pistol in My Pocket, may have come about because of this meeting. Talk to me about what happened in that meeting.
Well, let's see.
Because I know there's a bigger story, but talk to me about that meeting in particular.
I'll try and be succinct. So Jane County, the legendary rock and roll transsexual singer-performer, Jane County, formerly Wayne County of the Electric Chairs, came to London, stayed with me for what was going to be 2 weeks, ended up as 3 months. And she was friends with Pete Burns, who I'd met Pete Burns in Liverpool in the late 70s, actually, because when I came out of the kids' home in Grimsby Town, where I was born. Did you know I was born in the darkest parts? Grimsby Town in Lincolnshire. And I'd met Pete very briefly when he was a hairdresser in Liverpool, and it was very different then. Anyway, Jane was friends with him, and this was 1983, and they'd come down to London, dead or alive, and we're recording in a studio in Soho. So we went down there to have a cup of tea with them and a bit of a natter. And I loved what they were doing. And I thought, you know, and then I saw Pete on Top of the Pops with Dead or Alive. And I thought, ooh, I don't want to be them, but I want to be like them, meaning that I wanted my own hit. You know, I wanted my own signature. And anyway, come 1985, I was in the Comic Strip Presents on Channel 4 at the time with Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders, you know, Jennifer Saunders from the Absolutely Fabulous series with Joanna Lumley. And they were my erstwhile colleagues. And I was in the comic strip on the new Channel 4, and I was getting a lot of attention. And I just thought, well, you know, I'm a multifaceted performer and personality. I need to have my own, you know, I need to be doing a bit more. I need to, you know, play on those other strings on this bow. So I decided what I'll do is I'll just unannounced go and have, go to Vineyard Studios in the borough, in London, where Stock, Aitken & Waterman, Pete Waterman, was based. And I went in there. I think I must have been walking like Mae West. And I said to Pete, you know, I've got this track. You're going to love it, Pete. It's called Surrender Your Gender. So I started singing this punk track, Surrender Your Gender, a gender bender, because it was all gender bending in the 80s, you know, that period. And so Pete nearly fell off his chair in hilarious laughter. And I was staring at him thinking, how rude when I'm being really
You were being serious.
Yes, you know. And so anyway, he said, listen, Al, I don't think that's, you know, it's a good tune, nice concept, but I don't think it's going to get Radio 1 airplay. He said so. leave it with me and I'll be in touch with you. So anyway, 2 weeks came by. Didn't hear from him. So I gave him a ring and I said, so I thought you were getting in touch with me, Pete. And he said, yes, come in tomorrow. We've written a song for you. It's called Pistol in My Pocket. So I went into the studio, was there for about 4 hours recording, I got a pistol in my pocket, baby. So obviously I'd influenced him to get his writers Morrison Washbourne, and they wrote This Pistol in My Pocket for Lana Pillay, and Sheila Ferguson of the 3 Degrees did all the additional vocals on it, you know, like that. There's a segment in there that goes, is that a pistol in your pocket? A pistol in your pocket? Or are you just pleased to see me? Well, that's not me. That's Sheila Ferguson. I mean, I've done it recently on, you know, other mixes of it consequently. But so that was Sheila, and she did all the backing vocals on it. And so that's really how it came to fruition. I remember that Rick Astley, famous singer now, he used to be the tea boy in the studios. And, you know, Kylie and Jason had turned up a couple of times to do stuff in, you know, various studios at Vineyard. So anyway, you know, that's all that, how that all came to, how it all manifested and came to fruition.
When you heard the song, when you heard the track, what were your initial thoughts? Do you remember the initial feeling that you had?
Well, I thought, oh, it does sound like Dead or Alive. But then I thought, well, you know, Al, you've always been more alive than dead, so get on with it. And, you know, it was one of the few opportunities in my life that I was awake to. You know, there is some, you know, the universe would have, you know, it was as if like the universe was saying, don't be missing this one, kid. Jump onto it. You know, I mean, and then there was, after that, of course, I recorded with them, I Can Make a Man Out of You, a track.
And, that was your follow-up single.
Yeah.
Did you feel supported by, were you signed to a record company at that time or just like to individual singles?
No, well, I was signed to Stock Aitken & Waterman at the time. You know, that
and did you feel supported by them in terms of promoting you and getting your music out and your visuals out and who you were and are?
Well, I think I'd have gone a lot further had I not been, you know, so fractious, and had I had more of a stable view of life, really, because I was really quite, let's say, emotionally labile at the time. So, you know, they supported me as much as they could, you know, but like with all record companies, you have to keep your eye on the ball. You know, but certainly their promotional department worked me a lot. You know, I mean, I was working up to 7 nights a week doing PAs of it all over the country. I nearly came to Canada and I nearly came to Australia, except interviewers like Molly Meldrum from Australia's Countdown actually came over to meet me in London. So I think that was a way of the record company saving on the handbag, you know, flights and expenses of that. But
and the music video for Pistol in My Pocket.
Yes.
What a fun, great video. They've done an upscale version, an HD version that people can watch and enjoy on YouTube. It features Lee Bowery, who you knew and has he made you some clothes.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, Lee was, I was the first person Lee Bowery met when he came to London. It was 1981, and I used to have an ex-Hare Krishna friend who lived at the top of a really high, one of those big high Georgian houses opposite Hyde Park, Buckingham Palace. And I used to go around to Trevor to have his prasadam, which is what the Hare Krishnas call food. And so I went round one lunch, and after I'd finished lunch and, you know, was leaving Trevor's, I saw like this big sort of, well, I can only describe him as in the language that we used to use in the 80s, as a big puffy type blonde bleach hairdresser, all in black, with puff mutton leg shirt sleeves and that. Anyway, it was just struggling carrying loads of black bin liner bags and suitcases, and I said, "Ear, do you need some help, love?" And he said, "Oh, if you wouldn't mind," you know, in like his g'day Australian accent. And I'm terrible at Australian accents, and even though I've had quite a bit of Australian in me on occasion, you'd think I'd be able to speak it fluently with my eyes closed. So I helped him in with these, with all his luggage, and I said, "Oh, if you know, you move from another house." I said, "No, I've just moved here from Australia," and he nattered, and he said, "Oh, you remind me of Shirley Bassey," and I just immediately went in Shirley Bassey and said, "Well, is this something in the way I move?" And so we both laughed at that, and, you know, it was a nice connection. And then about 2 years later, I got a telephone call. I was in the comic strip on Channel 4. I got a telephone call at my home, and it was Lee. And he said, "Oh, do you remember me?" You know, and "Of course I do. What are you doing now?" "Oh, well, I'm doing fashion, and I'd like to make some outfits and stuff." And I said, "Oh, well, I'd love it." You know, met up with him in his Tower Hamlets flat. He used to live in a council flat, Tower Hamlets, with Star Trek wallpaper, and we became great friends, and he made me about 180 outfits in my time knowing him. I was a muse of Lee's, one of his first muses. I used to assist him when he was doing photo shoots for greeting cards and that, you know, and it just lasted until it run out of track, really. I think Lee's pathology on some levels got the better of him, and it put me off him. But I did like the good times that Lee and I had. I did like the times, the long, long Sunday afternoons we used to have, just chatting, edifying talk from him teaching me the piano, him teaching me how you cut fabric, egg and cress sandwiches on brown Hovis from Lipton's, you know, that was Lee, pots of Earl Grey tea, you know, just madness, really, yeah. And so that was my connection with Lee. And of course, recently, there'd been a very big tribute to him at the Tate Modern on the South Bank, which I featured quite prominently in. I mean, they had the video of Pistol in My Pocket in there on its own screen. And that certainly opened me up to a new generation of sort of club kids who want to have fun and dress up. That video was actually made by John Mabry, the filmmaker. It was part of our gang, Taboo Gang, in the 80s. And John had done the, what's the name, Sinead O'Connor video of Prince, when she covered Prince's Nothing Compares to You. He'd done that one. And he'd done mine. So, you know, what more can you ask for? And that's the
note, we will return after this Rainbow Country update.
I'm Brian Bradley, author of Outrageous Misfits, female impersonator Craig Russell and his wife, Lori Russellidi. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
Bill 7. To ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive Conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi there, I'm Bennett Singer, a documentary filmmaker and the co-director of the new film, Cured. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
We'll be right back.
So, Alana, we're talking about yourself, we're talking about your music, your influence, essentially who you are. You were just talking about, you know, 1986's Pistol in My Pocket. We're currently here in modern times. It's, what, 2026? And we're still talking about Pistol in My Pocket because in 2025, it was part of a 5-CD compilation from Disco Discharge Presents Morrison, full-length gay clubbing 1980 to 1989. Generally speaking, what are your thoughts on your music and who you are and all that you represent being introduced to a whole new crowd? What are your thoughts on that, generally speaking?
Well, everything old is new again, isn't it? You know, and also you can't, if you want to be really that cool, you've got to acknowledge and pay homage to tradition and that which went before, I think, you know. I just think it's great to stay buoyant, you know. I mean, I'm doing new music, but of course, you have to, it's like when you wake up in the morning, you know, you have to give thanks in a very spiritual way, not necessarily religious, but in a very spiritual way, you know, connect your spirit with the, and align it with the vibration of the universe and say, and thank it for what you already have, you know, in order for, you know, new stuff to come,
Your way.
Yes.
I want to ask you this question, and I hope you'll go here with me, because for me, I am androgynous. This is just who I am, a multiracial.
Oh, God, you can't tell.
But that's just who I am innately. I mean, back in the 80s, you had terms like transsexual. For yourself, do you feel today, with terms like gender non-binary or being transgender, do you feel like you've always been ahead of the curve, so to speak, but society has sort of caught up now? Have you always felt, you know, sort of, I don't want to say out of step, but have you always felt like you've been ahead of the curve and because of that have faced, you know, societal, yeah, like issues or that sort of thing, especially when it comes to gender and gender identity?
Well, listen, you know, I was a teenager in the 70s, and the mores of the times, 70s, 80s, even, you know, 60s, were very much different, hostile wise. I mean, it was my generation and generations that preceded mine that fought for the gains that this generation
absolutely
enjoys today. Mm-hmm. You know, we fought for all these kings and queens to wear their crowns with pride today. And it was our generations and the generations before that took most and all of the pain. Early in life, I always felt so misaligned with my body, that I mistook it for it being a transsexual issue rather than a spiritual one. And in 1984, I was actually diagnosed with transsexualism. And in the, what you say, contravening years, doing work on myself, having deep hypnotherapy, it's been revealed to me, you know, that I am a naturally androgynous, epicene, hyper effeminate natal male. You know, so I'm not transsexual at all. I don't actually get non-binary other than it being a trendy thing to be.
That's what I don't I've asked guests that have come on the show, and in their bio they might say they're gender non-binary, and I ask them, if you're neither male nor female and you don't identify with either of those, what do you identify with? How do you, you know what I'm saying? And being gender non-binary is almost like the absence of both, but then who are you?
Well, you know, what has happened, Mark, is that transness in the past decade has become so unregulated that anybody can self-identify anyhow they want. Now, as far as I'm concerned, you know, people say to me, but Lana, you're a woman. You're a woman. You're more like a woman than some of the women I know. And I'm like, well, you know, I can't help my energy. And yeah, you know, you could say that I'm, you know, like a woman, but for me to say that I am an actual woman is insanity in my mind. You know, I am a hyper effeminate, naturally androgynous epicene. You know, the word epicene, it means having characteristics of both sexes. But that doesn't make me a woman or stop me from being a male, you know. And I just think, you know, and I'm just really so sick of the whole trans debate and conversation, because for me, it's just been hijacked. I mean, real transsexual communities in the past decades have been gatecrashed by trans radical fascists, you know, who tend to be straight geezers claiming to be lesbian, crashing real women's spaces. I'm sorry, but that projects negatively on the rest of us, especially people like us who are just natural, natal, naturally androgynous. You know, it impacts negatively on the whole LGB community, mm-hmm. You know.
But I think, too, it's fair to say that there are people that have gender dysphoria and they're truly, like you said earlier, they feel truly out of alignment, and they're truly transgender, because
and they'll go to extremes. I mean, you know, I believe that my transsexualism was a trauma response, you know, to abused childhood, having to go into a home, seeing the girls being treated better, you know, than me, and thinking, oh, well, if I become a girl, you know, I'll get treated nice. You know, it's, you know, as a child, children will find all kinds of escape routes if they're being abused, you know. I think that was certainly pertinent to my early life period. Yes, of course, but the 1%, and I don't care, you know, what people say, because I know, having experienced that, transsexualism is a mental disorder. Now, just because somebody has a mental disorder doesn't mean to say that they're a psychopath, but you can't say that to trans radical fascists, because they're irrational, you know, and they don't want to have the debate. You know, it's like their backs are up. It's like truth is their enemy. Well, I'm sorry, but, you know, facts are facts, you know. And it's all this demand, you know, you must accept us for what we are. Well, why are you asking everyone to accept you for what you are when you can't even accept yourself for what you were? So let's not even go there. But I will always, you know, I'm not part of the trans fight. I don't embrace trans ideology. I believe that there are only two biological sexes, male and female. I I think there are, you know, zero tons of myriad genders, but there are infinite personalities. All right. Most of them deranged, including my own. But I just don't, you know, I don't embrace this ideology because I think it's been a psychogenic epidemic, and a lot of people have jumped on the bandwagon because they found their slice of the victim pie, and that's what they're playing out. And because my generation and generations before fought for the gains, you know, it's like they've had nothing really to fight for. So the only thing that they're suffering from, as far as I'm concerned, is not real gender dysphoria, like the 1%. The only thing that the trans types are suffering is oppression envy, as far as I'm concerned, because they've got to have something to scream and cry about. You know, this is what I've found in my findings. So I just don't believe it. I'm just unconvinced.
And those are your honest thoughts and opinions. But let's talk about love.
Snow is all around, down where the street lights glow, on this beautiful winter's evening, I think of you, the life we knew, and my soul is soaring back to you, winter.
Talk to me about the song and what it represents, Winter of Love.
Well, Winter of Love, I'd had a knee replacement operation in 2018, and I was here in Primrose Hill, London, in the apartment, and it was a miserable October afternoon, dark, and the brown and gold and red leaves were blowing all around. It was quite, you know, it reminded you of autumn in New York, basically. It started off good in the morning, you know, like that autumn sunshine, crisp sunshine, blue skies. And but anyway, it got grayer and grayer in the afternoon, and I was in quite a bit of pain, and I just thought, oh, rather than have more morphine, what should I do take my mind off this? And so I just started humming this tune, Winter of Love, burning in my heart. And I was obviously thinking about Christmas, one of my very, very favourite times of the year. And and then I just started penning the lyrics, Winter of Love. Winter of love, burning in my heart. Winter of love, shining like a star. And so I got so far, and then I got what I called stuck in the snow. And so I rang a friend, David, the rock musician, David Ryder Prangley, will you please come and help me out with this song, and I'll give you, you know, half the royalties if you, you know, help us. So anyway, we wrote the song together in the end, Winter of Love. And then come September last year, I thought, you know, we really need to you know, get this record and get it out before Christmas. So it was a real rush. And we recorded it over at Holloway Studios there and Plastic Sound Studios, Holloway. And then we got Pearl Drop Production Steward, really fantastic. Simon Mercer and his team at Pearl Drops did a really fantastic video to accompany it. And then Heritage Chart Show wanted it to put in their countdown to Christmas. And it did quite well. I think it went from, went in at 87, got to about 42. So that wasn't bad. And I thought, oh, well, I hope, you know, we get like a real triple A-list artist liking it and wanting to do a version of it. So, you know, that's always a dream. You know, it's always a dream to have it on a film, you know, soundtrack. It has that feel to it. So a song that came out of post-surgery pain and also reminiscence of all those loved ones that had gone before, because I part of my belief is spiritualism. And I view death as a fiction. I mean, obviously, it's quite upsetting when that happens, because we're in the human condition and we have human receptors and emotions. But from my personal experiences, and for others that I've listened to, I actually, well, you know, I see death as a fiction, almost as a knower, you know, when you know something, as a knower. So, so it was very reminiscent of that, because also I remember sort of spooky experience while I was writing parts of it in here, you know, nice warm kind of presence. So it was that, and I think it's open to interpretation. I mean, you know, some people would interpret it as a loved one that had passed away at Christmas, a loved one that had gone away through, you know, breakup, you know, somebody said to me actually only the other day that he thought of all the friends he'd missed through AIDS, not only in the 80s and 90s, but also more recently, even, you know, with PrEP and what have you, medication. So it's really open to interpretation. But, you know, it's just fulfilling that people like it, and also are quite surprised that I can write a song occasionally.
So, Alana, I just have a couple minutes left with you, but I want to end here. Quote: "Give in, give out, but don't give up." Unquote. Yeah. That's essentially, I guess, your life motto. Here's my last question for you. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've heard your music, after they've seen your videos, they've experienced Alana? What do you hope audiences come away with?
Well, I hope people see me as a universal type of performer and being. Also, in spite of this sort of monolithic political climate, when we're all supposed to embrace something that's forced on us, that I'm a vehement individual that has their own mind, that is a vehement critical thinker. I know, like, it's popular, there's a popular phrase that says, you know, stand in your own truth. Well, you know, I do stand in the truth of who I am, and I will always do so, even if it means standing alone. I hope people will appreciate my candor and the fact that such a theatrical creature am I. I'm not that glitzy and showbiz and intimidated in order not to say the things that I truly feel. I just hope that they, you know, appreciate my artistry and honesty and, you know, I just think that you've really just got to be your authentic self and, you know, have people hate you for what you really are rather than love you for what you're really not. You know, I think adversity introduces a person to themselves, and I've certainly had a lot of that, you know. I mean, you know, people can only be alienated from me if the truth is their enemy. So, you know, it's up to people, you know. I'm not the thinker inside their heads, you know, or hearts. It's entirely up to them, you know. But so long as I can always be honest, and so long as I can always be the type of person that tries to do whatever good they can from wherever they are with whatever they've got, then, you know, that's fine by me.
Well said, well said. Alana, well said, well done, well recorded. Thanks for your time. Thanks for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Bless you, Mark. Thank you ever so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you. It was a pleasure to see your picture looking so Shaka Khan, Shaka Khan, Shaka Khan. Actually, you look like one of the Sisters Sledge.
I love them.
Yeah, you look fantastic, Mark.
Thank you.
And hopefully, if ever you come over to London, you'll get in touch with me so we can have a cuppa and a plate of fish and chips.
Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
That was my spotlight on British musical artist Alana Pillay. Their current single is Winter of Love. Pistol in My Pocket is part of the 5-CD set Disco Discharge Presents More Sin, Box of Sin 2, full-length gay clubbing 1980 to 1989, a compilation well worth the investment.
Hi, I'm songwriter and producer Jim Valance, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hour 2 of Rainbow Country. Gary Clayle's 1991 top 10 hit, Human Nature, featuring Alana Pillay.
intolerance.
Unlimited Canada works with landowners and other conservation-minded partners to improve outcomes for communities and wildlife. Supporting vital ecosystems which contribute to water quality and quantity, soil health, support agriculture and economy, mitigate severe weather events, and provide opportunities for recreational access to nature. Together, we are unlimited. Learn more about programs and partnerships at ducks.ca.
Colon cancer is the number two killer of all cancers. It can affect anyone. But with early detection, the survival rate is estimated at 90%. The key? A simple test you do in your own home.
I'm Ann Murray, and I lost a very dear friend to colon cancer. He was 49, and had he been tested, he might still be with us.
Talk to your doctor. Get your test. Not knowing is not the answer.
For more information or to donate, visit coloncancercanada.ca. Colon Cancer Canada. We're behind, you're behind.